Hey everyone, Marco Werman here. If you're listening to this podcast and looking forward to hearing the latest news, but you have not yet donated to our end of 2020 campaign, you still have time. We need only 86 more people, just 86, to raise their hands and give in the final hours of the year. Donate $100 or more to the world and you'll receive an invite to a virtual party with me and the team. You'll get to ask questions, get access to exclusive behind-the-scenes stories, and much more. We need you. Your contribution allows us here at The World to continue to bring you the original global reporting you depend on. Donate today to help keep our independent journalism free and accessible to anyone in every corner of the globe. Visit theworld.org/give to donate today. Be one of the 86 to get us there. And from every one of us here at The World, thank you. Just when you were ready to celebrate the promise of the new year.
We're not going to be able to go back to the pre-Trump, pre-COVID world. There's going to be a new normal that starts to emerge in 2021.
A new normal today on The World, but also some favorite stories to help us get ready for the next 12 months.
That whole idea of nostalgia. You know, I don't think people necessarily miss the smell of a pub, if they're being honest.
Old beer and stale potato chips, candles that smell like places we can't visit right now. And Mexican pro wrestling forges on.
I don't know if all the people who are listening to us know that there's nothing impossible for the Mexicans.
Plus, getting a degree in ninja studies. Sure, we got time. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and much more on this New Year's Day edition of The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It is Friday. Welcome to the end of the week and welcome to a new year, one that officially began in the Western Pacific. Everybody loves it. Australia kicked things off, as always, with fireworks. This year, though, the Australian government urged people to watch from home. 2021 then swept across Asia with mostly small celebrations. In Tokyo, a temple bell marked the moment. Hours later, 2021 arrived in the Middle East. Dubai draws a lot of elites and typically hosts one of the world's biggest New Year's parties. This year was no exception. The world's tallest building, the Burj Khalifa, was lit up with a dazzling display of fireworks and projected images. On the streets there, a lot of people ignoring social distancing. Across Europe, a far more muted affair, with capitals largely deserted. In London, a celebration of sorts when Big Ben struck 11 p.m., which was midnight in continental Europe, the appointed time for the UK to finally sever ties with the European Union. Yes, a major headline dropped with the new year: Brexit is official. That means Brits can no longer live and work in the rest of Europe without a visa. And British students, gone is their year to study on the other side of the English Channel. For many young Brits, the Erasmus program had become a rite of passage. The World's Europe correspondent, Orla Barry, has more on that.
Hashim Mohammed was 23 when he arrived in Saint-Étienne in France on an Erasmus program. It was the summer of 2005.
One of the first impressions was how dirty the streets were, actually, because I remember at the time, people just didn't seem to pick up after their dogs.
Mohammed, a British citizen, was studying law at the University of Hertfordshire in England. It was his French teacher, who was originally from Saint-Étienne, who encouraged Mohammed to go there as part of Erasmus. And it was a decision that changed his life.
It fundamentally transformed the way I see the world, the way I see myself, the way I see my future prospects, and just the way I think as well.
Mohammed was 9 when he came to the UK as an unaccompanied child refugee from Kenya. He says he was raised mainly on state benefits. Many of the Conservative MPs who this week welcomed the decision to end Britain's involvement in Erasmus have called the scheme a paid gap year for middle-class students. But Mohammed says, for him and many others, this couldn't be further from the truth. Andrew Patrick White from Dublin agrees. White grew up in a single-parent family in Ireland. He tells me his Erasmus experience changed him too, although he didn't quite know what to expect when he landed at Hanover Airport in Germany in 1993.
I didn't even know my address. They'd organised some accommodation for me, but I didn't know where it was, what it was like. That evening, I was sleeping in a farmhouse on the north side of the town, so it was all a massive kind of unknown journey.
White came to love the German food, the language, and even some German music. he fell in love with an Italian woman too. But it was the friends he made through Erasmus that left a lasting impression.
It was just really, for the first time outside Dublin, meeting, you know, like-minded people. Some were from Stockholm, some were from Helsinki, Lyon or Porto, but three of those are now, you know, 22 years later, some of my closest friends.
Hashim Mohammed says his experience led to lifelong friendships too. Summer 2005 saw violent protests breaking out across Paris against police harassment of immigrant communities. The unrest also spread to other French cities. Mohammed says it sparked many conversations among his friends about what it meant to be French, European, and an immigrant, and it made him rethink his view of Britain.
I came back to the UK in many ways with a real sense of understanding that in Britain, I certainly had a better ride in life because of the fact that Britain was a much more open, more tolerant to multicultural communities than perhaps France was.
Mohammed, who's now a barrister and author, says in spite of Brexit, he still believes this to be true. The UK government says it plans to replace Erasmus next year with a new British project called the Turing Programme, named after the famous mathematician. This will allow students to study in universities around the world, not just in Europe. But many are asking how the UK will manage such a costly venture. Paul James Cardwell is law professor at Strathclyde University in Glasgow.
There's really lots and lots of practical challenges which mitigate against setting up new agreements and new schemes in the period of time that we have.
Cardwell has reason to be sceptical. He's organised exchange programmes with universities across Europe. Creating new exchanges with universities in other parts of the world could mean much higher tuition fees, travel costs and visa issues. Cardwell says the government is also forgetting one key benefit of the Erasmus programme for Britain.
We talk a lot about students going out, but students coming in from elsewhere in the EU bring enormous benefits, financially obviously to the cities where they're living, but also in terms of soft power. Students who've come to the UK are informal ambassadors for the UK.
Danish master's student Rega Uldel could be one of those informal ambassadors. Uldel went to Bournemouth University in England as part of the Erasmus programme just 2 years ago. The food didn't impress her much.
Oh yeah, it sucks.
Uldel says a family friend even warned her about British cuisine.
She's born and raised in England. And when she learned that I was going to go on exchange, she texted me and she was like, watch out for the food, it's going to kill you.
But Uldel survived and has come to love Britain. She tells me the whole experience made her reevaluate the way she views life.
I was lucky enough to become really good friends with some other girls who were also on exchange and some local guys. And they were just very much in touch with everything around them. Like, they sort of just knew what was important in life.
Uldel says she'd love to live in Britain again, but Brexit may make that challenging. And Britain's decision to end its link with Erasmus means Danes, like her, and many other Europeans, will no longer have the opportunity to study in the UK. For Hashim Mohammed in London, he tells me it's young people here in Britain he feels most sorry for.
I think young Brits are going to be culturally poorer in many ways. You know, Hashi from 2006 had those opportunities. The Hashi of 2020 just that won't have that now, and I'm really sad about that.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson says the new Turing programme will allow British students go to some of the best universities in the world next year. But so far, he's given little detail on how Britain is going to make that happen. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
There's a lot of hope riding on 2021, but the big question is, how realistic are these hopes? After all, we began 2020 with a lot of hope, and look what happened there. Every year, The Economist magazine takes a look at the important trends that will shape the year ahead. The World in 2021 is edited by The Economist deputy editor, Tom Standage. He spoke with my colleague, Carol Hills, from London.
Tom, before we get to thoughts on this new year, a quick look back at 2020 and what is spilling over. And of course, the biggest thing is vaccine distribution. How much of our predictions for this new year depend on getting this logistical challenge right?
An enormous amount does, because it really does sort of set the landscape for so much else that follows. The nature of the economic recovery and the speed of the economic recovery depends on how quickly vaccines can be manufactured, distributed, and actually administered to people. And then also, you know, other things like political implications follow from what happens with the vaccine. So really, it is an awful lot hanging on exactly how quickly these things can be made and distributed.
When you're pondering the year ahead and coming up with these predictions, in the case of vaccine distribution as the key one, is there a time in 2021 where you'll think, okay, we actually, this is working. Everything else can happen because this is working now.
Well, that time may come in 2021 for some people in some countries. But if you're looking at the world as a whole, which is what we do at The Economist, then no, I don't think there will be a point where that will be the case for everybody. It will come at different times in different places. I think even in the richest countries that have reserved a lot of the vaccine production for themselves, including Britain and the United States, we'll be lucky if we get to sort of 70 or 80% coverage by the end of 2021, I'd have thought.
One of the many things 2020 taught us, at least for those in certain industries, is the work from home factor. Where do you see remote working and distance learning going in 2021?
Yes, I think that's one of the really big questions for this year, which is to what extent do the new behaviours that many people adopted during 2020, whether it's schooling from home, working from home, seeing a doctor remotely, all sorts of new business models emerging. And the big question for this year is how much of that behaviour goes away and how much of it sticks. And it's very clear that it's not all going to stick. And so the answer, it turns out, varies depending on the country you're in and the activity you're talking about. So if you look at online shopping, for example, Italy was a real laggard in the adoption of e-commerce. Italians much prefer to buy things in person in shops. And by various measures, they have jumped forward about 10 years in their adoption of e-commerce during 2020. In the US, the leap forward was about 4 years. So in other words, the volume of e-commerce has ended up at the end of 2020 being about where it was expected to be at the end of 2024. But things like working from home, again, that's going to vary a lot by industry and by country. We should remember that even in the richest countries, less than half of the workforce is able to work from home. So most people can't. And I think, you know, it's very easy for people in our position to sort of say, now that we all work from home and so on, we don't. But again, there are variations within not just industries, but within countries. So if you look at bosses in Europe and America, they are very happy to say that in future, you know, they can imagine people working from home 2 or 3 days a week. If you ask people in China, only 4% of bosses say that. So again, there is no single answer. And that means that there's going to be a very sort of unpredictable emergence of a new normal.
China's economy has fared relatively well during the pandemic. The U.S. just keeps buying more and more stuff from there. President Trump based a lot of his presidency on halting this trend. Is there anything that can be done to tilt the balance of U.S.-Chinese trade back toward the U.S. under a new Biden administration?
I don't think Joe Biden is going to want to just call off Donald Trump's trade war with China. I think he's going to want to continue to prosecute it, but I think he's going to want to do it in a more organized way, which is that if you can get all of the Western powers together on the same team on this, then you're much more likely to be able to get China to respond when you want to change the terms of trade, when you criticize it about human rights and so forth. Donald Trump has managed to completely fragment the Western coalition on this. And as a result, you know, China can pretty much do what it wants. So I think what we'll see with Joe Biden is he won't get rid of Donald Trump's tariffs. He'll actually continue a lot of Donald Trump's policies, quite surprisingly, when it comes to China. But I think there will be some areas where Joe Biden will try to find common ground. And I think climate is the most obvious. So I think there's going to be more continuity in China policy than you might expect.
And of course, later this month here in the U.S., we will have Joe Biden as our new president. To say he has a lot on his plate is perhaps the understatement of the year. Beyond the pandemic, what are the most pressing areas he needs to concentrate on to help restore confidence and trust in our global institutions?
Well, I think he's going to have domestic priorities initially. So dealing with the pandemic and getting a recovery and stimulus bill through are going to be jobs one and two, I would have thought. And they're, of course, very closely related because, as we were saying earlier, the ability to revive the economy really depends on getting on top of the pandemic. So I think he'll be focusing on that. And then, yes, when it comes to foreign policy, trying to rebuild those alliances and trying to, the expression he's using is America is back. So trying to reassure America's traditional allies that all of the things Donald Trump said and did about undermining NATO and pulling out of various multilateral organizations, being rude about globalization, talking about America first, cozying up to dictators and so on and so on. It's going to take a while for Joe Biden to get round to all of those different alliances that have been damaged. But I think, as with the pandemic, the idea that you can flick a switch and go back to the world the way it was, it's not true with US foreign policy either. We're not going to be able to go back to the pre-Trump, pre-COVID world. There's going to be a new normal that starts to emerge in 2021.
That's Tom Standage, deputy editor of The Economist, speaking with The World's Carol Hills about the magazine's annual look at the global trends in the coming year. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. After 2020, it's hard to know what getting back to normal might look like, or even if there will be a return to what we used to consider normal. Around the globe this past year, we've seen people everywhere come up with smart new ways of coping. For the rest of this hour, we'll take another look at some of the most inspiring ones. In the meantime, we can comfort ourselves with Nostalgia, a London candle shop that is making scented candles that smell like our old everyday lives. Sense of Normality, they call it. That's S-C-E-N-T-S. Paul Furman is co-creator of Earl of East Candles. So you've got cinema, in case people were missing their artificial butter smells. What are some of your other candle scents and what aromas stand out?
For this collection, we actually worked in partnership with Uncommon, which is a creative agency based in London. And they approached us with the idea to kind of recreate the places people had missed most. So the cinema is obviously, I think, without doubt, one of those for a lot of people. But we've also created the festival. The lead note in that candle is cut grass, but there is kind of hemp and cannabis oil in there. And then we also created the local, you know, the pub is kind of a staple in people in the UK's weekly lives. So, we recreated that scent too.
I mean, people who are thinking, you know, like sandalwood are sadly mistaken here. Like the pub candle, you've got top notes of spilt beer and the fat off of French fries. So, I mean, you're not just capturing the good, but also the bad. How'd you decide which kind of aromatic notes to include?
When the agency approached us, they were like, it's super important that we kind of run with these scents and try and make them as close to real life as possible. So for us, you know, setting that brief to ourselves was quite clear. I mean, you can't have a pub without beer, or a festival without cannabis, or a cinema without popcorn. So it was a really fun project to work on, actually, and something that wasn't as difficult as I think a lot of people think it would be in terms of that scent creation.
You're a candle maker and a business person, but why do you think scent in particular is so tied to people's memories?
Scent and memory are really closely linked because it's the same part of the brain that decode both. So that's why you can be walking down the street and the smell of smoke might instantly remind you of a grandparent or an uncle, or a perfume can literally transport you to a place or time. I think at this time, that whole idea of nostalgia, I don't think anybody could have predicted what would happen. And I think it was those simple things that people really craved. You know, I don't think people necessarily miss the smell of a pub, if they're being honest, but not being able to experience it, there was something quite nice about that. But I think what's been interesting is it's one of the ones out of the three scents that people have really responded to after. We've seen a lot of people like posting pictures of them recreating like pub food and lighting it as part of a almost like a ritual of recreating something they've missed during that time. And I think that's really nice.
What are some of the other smells that you miss, Paul, from before lockdown?
In the very early days, kind of March and April, the things I was missing were more associated with food. Like the smell of going past like a bakery or a coffee shop, they were the things that I really missed. So yeah, quite foodie smells. I'm still at this point really missing the smell of the ocean, and definitely kind of craving that a little bit, particularly as some people are starting to travel again. And we've kind of made a conscious decision not to, but seeing it everywhere on social and stuff is kind of making me really crave that at the moment.
Paul Furman, the co-creator behind Earl of East Candles in London, their new line, Sense of Normality, captures the smells of some of the places you may have missed during the lockdown. Paul, thank you so much for your time. Good to speak.
Thank you.
How will pro sports move ahead safely? Well, the NBA figured it out, but generally the sporting world has had a rough go of it during the pandemic. In Mexico, though, one pro wrestling company is not giving up. As we heard from the world's Jorge Valencia in Mexico City, they've been organizing bouts of lucha libre at the drive-in.
Even if everyone's staying in their car, it's pretty rowdy out here. A few dozen drivers are parked around a wrestling ring. They pound their horns. They switch on their radios for the play-by-play. And the announcers are just as excited as anyone.
Vámonos! La acción de Autolucha Triple A Worldwide!
There are five matches on this particular Saturday.
Máximo
is a muscular wrestler wearing a hot pink mohawk. Tito Santana is wearing black stripes on his face. And Mr. Iguana is crawling between cars. He's wearing a reptilian green suit. And like all Mexican lucha libre wrestlers, Mr. Iguana keeps his civilian identity to himself. But he later says that the fans yelling around him are the most important part of a fight.
It's almost like a 90%. The only 10% is your will and your soul to give it everything. So it's amazing when you hear it, when you hear the honking, then you get fired up.
Motivation aside, today is not the day for Mr. Iguana.
I couldn't get up because I got a chair shot to my face, so I was like knocked out.
A chair to your face?
Yep, chair shot in my head.
And yet, today is a victory for all the wrestlers carrying on Mexico's tradition of rough and extravagant lucha libre, which literally translates to free fighting. The Mexican government banned arena events across the country since the beginning of the pandemic, leaving thousands of wrestlers looking for work elsewhere. But one of the country's biggest wrestling companies, AAA, figured out a way to hold fights here in Mexico City beginning this month. Jose Manuel Guillen is one of the play-by-play announcers.
Autoluchas is a new way to make lucha libre here in Mexico. You can come on your car. You can see the matches in a big structure and to stay safe for all the pandemic situation.
Most wrestlers agree the experience doesn't compare to bouts in arenas. But as Guillen says, everything has changed in the new normal.
I don't know if all the people who are listening to us know that there's nothing impossible for the Mexicans.
And that's especially the case for a tradition so many here are so passionate about. Dania Rivas pulled up to the fights with her niece, her brother, and her sister-in-law. She explains, this isn't just a sport. Lucha libre is an art form and a part of Mexican culture, Rivas says. By the way, she's partial to the wrestlers who break the rules, so she was happy to see Mr. Iguana get knocked out with a chair to the face. Mexican culture is a culture of warriors, Rivas says. That's also why the country has so many boxing champions. Her brother, Cesar Mauricio Rivas, interrupts her. Mexicans are good at everything and power through, Cesar Mauricio says. And he adds, we're going to get through COVID too.
Y este COVID, mira.
For the world, I'm Jorge Valencia in Mexico City.
It was a year to remember, to say the least. On this first day of a new year, we're looking forward, but also remembering how we got here. We collected some of our favorite stories from 2020. You can find those right now at theworld.org. You're listening to The World. Hi, Marco Werman here, pausing the show for one of the last times this year, I promise. These final hours of 2020 are crucial for The World's fundraising campaign. We need just 86 more people to complete our goal of 1,000 donors. That's you. Yep, you, listening while you're making dinner, or over your morning coffee, or while you're cleaning the house. No matter when you listen, now is the time to act. We're incredibly grateful to each and every one of our donors, and we want to meet you. Donate $100 or more to The World today, right now, and you'll receive an invite to a virtual party with me and The World team. Visit theworld.org/give to donate today. Remember, you only have until the end of this crazy year to join. Go to theworld.org/give. And from everybody here at The World, thank you so much. This is life right now. We're surrounded by people and things we want to interact with, but they're out of reach. Also true for folks at the International Space Station.
I mean, you look down and Earth is right there, and it's really not so far away. It's just you can't get there.
Advice on patience and perseverance from space. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Here's a story about getting through hard times, some inspiration from another crisis that can help as we enter a new year shaped by this pandemic. The small eastern Caribbean island of Dominica was walloped by Hurricane Maria in 2017. It's still rebuilding. Here's how one well-known Dominican there is keeping track of her own recovery through music.
My name is Ophelia Marie, and people call me Ophelia. I am Dominica's Lady of Song.
For 40 years, Ophelia's signature sound has been cadence lipso, a fusion of calypso from Trinidad and Tobago, along with cadence dance music from Haiti. Ophelia's 1970s lament, Ai Dominique, became a kind of national anthem for the country that was first a French, then a British colony. Recently, Ophelia stood in the garden in front of the guest cottages she rents out and told us her story.
When we heard Hurricane Maria was coming, nobody took it as seriously as perhaps we should have. First it was rain, then it became wind and rain, and then the wind got very serious and took off the roofs of many of the buildings. So we were in the house and we expected to stay there. But when we saw the water just pouring into the drawing room where we were, we put our hats and our raincoats on and ran into the studio. We prayed, we sang songs, we created little chants for us to sing just to keep us going. One of them is, it will be fine, it will be fine. It will be fine, oh, it will be fine. It will be fine, I see you dancing. It will be fine, it will be fine. Oh, it will be fine. That one hasn't been recorded, but it was something that kept us going. It will be fine, oh, it will be fine. It will be fine, oh. At the end of the hurricane, 10 apartments we had, all of them lost their roofs. One of them was really very badly beaten, and they didn't want me to climb up to see all of the damage in the apartments because they thought I probably would cry. But I didn't cry. I said, okay, Maria did her work. Now it's ours. So it was really very devastated. We had work to do. We know we had to clean. It was time to assess and reassess and just get going again. It's obvious that the music had to stay because the studio stayed and nothing in the studio got disrupted, nothing. So for me, that likes to see and interpret the things that happen in my environment, I believe I just must continue. But we recorded, I think, an entire year afterwards, if not longer, because I got down. I really got down and I did not want to record those negatives. So I waited until I could crawl back up and become the smiling person that I prefer to be before I put down the songs. Energy, harmony. The one I like that keeps coming is called L'Étoile du Matin, that is the morning star. And it brings me to the time when, after the hurricane, I came out and I said, okay, so Maria, you have done your work. Now let me do mine. I did more covers than my own compositions. I was in the place where, again, I was looking to sell hope, to sell unity, to sell peace. You know, you fake it till you make it. So that's kind of the kind of cover I would do. From the Bible to the Quran. Baruata Adonai is Jerusalem. I also do the French, some of the French pops like Avec toi, je suis si bien. It's French African, and it says, with all of you, I am so fine. All of us, we all felt the rain, we all saw the wind. So we all have to respond in a positive way to make the negatives go away. That's where I am today.
What a great repertoire. Dominica's grand dame of song there, Ophelia Marie, talking about how music helped her cope with the aftermath of Hurricane Maria in 2017. Some lessons of resilience there for all of us. Ophelia told her story last spring to the world's Carolyn Beeler. Even being resilient doesn't do away with the fact that the fatigue from the pandemic is real. Keeping vigilant about wearing a mask, staying away from friends and family. There's stress, there's isolation, it's all exhausting. And yet the virus continues to spread, mutating in some places, and rates of infection and death continue to rise.
We need even more resolve. I know everyone is tired. I know that, you know, we're all kind of fed up with this and we want this to be over.
Boy, do we want this to be over. That's Maria van Kerkhove speaking this week. She's an epidemiologist with the World Health Organization.
And for those of us who are able to work from home and stay at home, you know, we reduce the opportunity for the virus to spread, which reduces burden on health systems, and this breaks chains of transmission. So it's important that all of us play our part. All of us do what we can to reduce the spread, because all of this gets us one step closer to ending the pandemic.
So more resolve, more patience to keep following the guidelines. How about some expertise in social distancing from a totally different field of science, space travel? The world's Amanda McGowan has been getting advice from someone whose profession is all about living far away from friends and family, like really far away.
When astronaut Katie Coleman was living on the International Space Station, she'd often look out the window and down at Earth.
I felt close. I mean, you look down and Earth is right there and it's only 250 miles away. I mean, it's really not so far away. It's just you can't get there.
Coleman lived on the space station for 6 months, and that's a long time to be far from home. So like a lot of us are doing right now, she made a big effort to feel as close as she could by staying connected. She called loved ones from the special phone on board, and she also did this. Coleman is a flute player. She's actually played in not one, but two all-astronaut bands. And she figured out a creative way to practice with them from space. Kind of.
And so I took the MP3s that I had of our band playing different songs, and I would put that on the computer, and I would be up in the cupola, which is our window on the world. It's got these, you know, windows all around and a big one right up top. And I would listen to that music and play along as if we were playing in the same place together. And it made me feel as if we were.
But space isn't just one big concert in the sky all the time. An astronaut's days are filled with lots of tasks that don't have immediate payoffs. Organizing food, doing maintenance on the space station, conducting physics experiments. Coleman says she had to remind herself that all of these things, over time, would contribute to the mission. Setting the stage for future exploration of places like the moon and Mars. And Coleman says this idea, mundane tasks adding up to something bigger, that's where space and this current pandemic are sort of alike.
What does this action that I'm taking right now, what does it really mean? What does it mean if I wash my hands one more time when I know I should, but I don't really feel like it, and does it make a difference?
Coleman says, yes, it does make a difference. Washing your hands or telling a loved one not to go out, these things really matter.
The steps may not be, they may not be exciting. You know, we may not be able to stand up and say, I figured out the vaccine for the virus. But the fact that we stay home, the fact that we figure out how we can help other people, every one of those actions counts. There's no question in my mind.
Washing your hands, it's not rocket science. But right now, it's all part of the mission. For the world, I'm Amanda McGowan.
Isolation is not something you think about around New Year's. Almost everywhere on Earth, it's a holiday of parties, lots of food and drink, and lots of people. Not this year. Missing out on meals together reminded us of a restaurant owner in Ronsiter, Sweden. I spoke with him last summer.
Right now the sun is shining and cherry trees are blossoming a little bit behind us. And it's beautiful that just a couple of weeks ago, cows were roaming these fields.
Rasmus Persson is co-owner of Board for N, or Table for One. It's exactly what it sounds like. One table, one chair, set up in that meadow that Rasmus was standing in there. At Table for One, your meal is delivered in a picnic basket on a pulley. With the pandemic forcing us to readjust our habits and social lives, Persson leaned in hard to the idea of what we can learn from dining alone.
For us, the sole act of eating is like, it's an amazing experience. And also in these times, it feels like everyone on my Facebook and everyone in every feed that I have are like frustrated and dying to go out there and meet people and socialize. And I get it, I'm the same. But instead of channeling the frustration, we wanted to do something where we say to everyone that, like, it's okay to spend time with yourself. You're worth spending time with.
How much does it cost to dine at Table for One, one person?
We realized instantly that to start a restaurant with one guest each day, you're never going to make any money out of that. So instead, we decided to pay tribute to the fact that a lot of people are facing huge obstacles right now in life. People have lost their jobs, for one, but a lot of people have lost their loved ones. And what we wanted to do was have this experience cost as much as you as a guest feel that you can spare, basically.
I'm looking at a picture of one of the tables and chairs in the meadow. It seems like it would be actually a really pleasant experience, almost introspective. What kind of experience do you hope guests have?
I think you're right on the money there. We're really trying to have this be an experience where you travel within yourself. Each course will also be curated with a poem. We've had friends help us to pick out poems, and we want to do our best to make sure that every guest that we have this summer have a respite, is that what you say, or like a break from all the stress and drama in life that everyone's facing right now.
Rasmus, thank you very much, and good luck with the restaurant.
Take care, man.
Rasmus Persson is the chef at the pop-up restaurant Board for N, or Table for One. He co-owns it with his girlfriend, Linda Carlson. Last summer, they served socially distanced meals with a side of poetry and philosophy in their meadow in Ronsiter, Sweden. 2 years ago, in the mountains south of Tokyo, a Japanese university started a ninja studies course. At the time, some said it was just a novelty. No one's laughing now. The course has proven itself, publishing credible research on the lives of ancient ninjas and training students to live a ninja lifestyle. In fact, this year, in the middle of the pandemic, they handed out their first ninja studies degree. The world's Patrick Nguyen has more.
Genichi Mitsuhashi isn't a 21st century ninja per se. He's just the only person on Earth with a master's degree in ninja studies. I found an online video from the Japan Ninja Council that shows him in action. In this video, Mitsuhashi shows how to kill someone with just a towel. While his classmates studied engineering and medicine, Mitsuhashi, who is 45, he was learning things like ancient combat and espionage.
It's called the Ninja Study Course, and this course is not a joke.
That's Yuta Sakai from the Ninja Studies Center. It's based at Mie University, located near forests that were once Japan's ninja heartland. And Sakai says students there have to do scholarship, learning techniques from 17th century scrolls.
Even Japanese cannot read such old Japanese characters.
Understanding the ninja, he says, means getting away from pop culture stereotypes.
Yeah, everybody know ninja. And most of people think ninja is black costume and bad people.
But they weren't necessarily bad people. They were covert agents, usually a samurai warrior, but specializing in spycraft. Sakai says maybe 1% of the samurai were ninjas.
The most important thing is survive.
To understand historical ninjas, you have to unlearn a lot of stuff from movies and video games, he says. Like, people think all ninjas use throwing stars. They're called shuriken in Japanese. Tourists in Japan can go to ninja shows where guys in black robes throw them with precision. But Sakai says this shuriken throwing star stuff is kind of phony. Ninjas didn't really use them. It just wasn't practical, he says.
You have a shuriken in pocket and running. It's too dangerous.
What ninjas did use a lot, he says, is fire. They like to set fires to distract their enemies, to slip in fortresses unnoticed. And that is a part of the ninja studies course.
We have the laboratory for the fire stuff.
It's like a chemistry lab where students learn about handheld bombs, smoke bombs, even flaming arrowheads.
Unfortunately, students cannot touch this because it's too dangerous.
Only the instructor gets to shoot flaming arrows. Now, on a typical day, Sakai says, ninjas weren't doing anything dramatic. They had swords, but he says they'd rather use them to cut through a wall and sneak in someone's home than face a bunch of enemies head on.
The most important thing is survive.
To stay alive, historical ninjas had to be charming, Sakai says, to seem non-threatening to strangers. People think they were all about violence.
But their skill is make a friend and escape from the war.
In fact, he says they dressed like regular people. Genichi Mitsuhashi, the recent grad, he actually spent a lot of time chopping wood and farming. But what does one do with a ninja studies degree anyway? Well, if Mitsuhashi was in Japan's feudal era, an extremely chaotic time when lots of fiefdoms were battling for power, he could apply for a job, Sakai says, with a warlord. Just like the US has the CIA, warlords also needed spies.
Each warlord has ninjas. They offer the job and they get the salary.
In modern times, Mitsuhashi will focus on running his martial arts school up in the mountains in an area called Iga. As for the ninja studies course, it only accepts a few students a year. Fluent Japanese is required. Still, Sakai says they are getting more applications these days. And I can't help but ask, Mr. Sakai, you're a ninja studies scholar, but do you have any ninja skills yourself?
Oh, interesting question. If I had the ninja skills, I will not talk about it.
Fair enough. For the world, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
Maybe somewhere in your kitchen, you have a handwritten recipe passed down from your mother or grandmother. If so, you'll appreciate this next story. One of the largest collections of historic Mexican cookbooks in the world can be found at the University of Texas at San Antonio. Some of these recipe books date back to the 1700s. Many are handwritten. Last year, the library started compiling recipes from these books and releasing them online as free ebooks so home cooks could discover them during lockdown. Amy Rushing is the Assistant Dean for Special Collections at the University of Texas at San Antonio, and Chef Rico Torres is co-owner of the acclaimed restaurant Michli in San Antonio. Torres wrote the foreword for the ebook. The World's Carol Hill spoke with them about the project last summer.
Amy, describe what this collection looks like.
The entire collection is around 2,000 published and unpublished Mexican cookbooks in both Spanish and in English. The oldest cookbook is one of these handwritten recipe books. We call them manuscript cookbooks. It's from 1789. But we also collect all the way to the present because we really want to try to build a broad and deep collection to show the evolution and the history of Mexican food.
And visually, do you see pictures of the old pieces of paper with the handwritten recipe, or how does it look on the page?
Well, we actually have two different ways to access the collection online. So the first is that we've been digitizing these manuscript cookbooks since around 2012. And in the collection, we have around 100 of them, but 55 are currently digitized and online in their entirety. And for this recetas, we decided while a lot of us are working from home, maybe looking to expand our culinary skills or experiment, we thought it would be a really interesting idea to take selections of recipes from the collection not just the manuscript cookbooks, but some of the published cookbooks as well, and compiled them into a little mini digital cookbook that we could share online. And we started with desserts because who doesn't like desserts?
Rico, as a chef, what interested you in opening up access to this huge collection of historic recipes?
When I got invited to go visit the library a couple of years ago, when I met Amy and the rest of the team, that was a really special moment for me because I knew that what we were doing at the restaurant, which is to rescue, to preserve, to promote Mexican gastronomy, to tell the history, not only of the country itself, but the history of how Mexico as an agricultural cradle to the world has changed and really given us some of our favorite recipes all around the world, you know, from Pomodoro sauces to Spanish chorizo. When I got to actually see the collection, especially some of the earlier manuscripts, especially the handwritten ones, they were in themselves a work of art because they're so beautifully written. The language changes and the spelling sometimes changes throughout the century, but a lot of times the recipes aren't changing. And that kind of, for us, was very important to see how the foundation of the cuisine itself is still rooted in chiles and tomatoes and a lot of the ingredients that were indigenous to the area.
Amy, I want to congratulate you for starting with dessert. That's, of course, the first ebook you've published called Postres, or Desserts. What are some of the recipes people can find in there?
One really interesting one that we thought we would put in there is a quinceañera cake. It's huge. It takes 105 eggs. And it gives really detailed instructions on how to decorate it. And we just thought that would be a really interesting recipe to include.
Rico, when you look at these old recipes, what do you notice about the ingredients and the cooking techniques? I mean, are they dishes that are familiar to a modern Mexican palate?
Some of the foundations are definitely familiar. What you see in the beginning of salsas or braises or stews or caldos, the desserts, it's all there. But some of the stuff that I really love about it, because it's so rustic in itself, is like the use of the nuts and the seeds and the piñones, the use of corn in really interesting ways where you can have a dessert or a drink or a masa application to it, or the kernel itself cooked in a variety of ways, and you can have pozole. That's always interesting. One of the things that I always chuckle about it is about a century back, you'll see a lot of recipes that use boiled ham and hard-boiled eggs and just about everything. And I think that just, you know, kind of tells the story of how difficult it was to source things. I mean, you can't just go to your local grocery store and get whatever you wanted like you can nowadays. Back then, you had to use what you had. And on top of that, you see immigrants that are making new lives in Mexico trying to recreate dishes that they're, you know, fond of from back home, like a paella, but restricted to the ingredients in Mexico. And I saw one where saffron was substituted for rajas of poblano, or thin strips of poblano.
Rico, do you have any of the old recipes? Are any of them things that you create at Michli?
We had a recipe for chilacuali. It's a mole from the Huasteca Veracruzana, part of the Veracruz culture. That one's on the menu right now. It's an almond-based mole with pasilla peppers. It actually has cacao in it. Not every mole does, but this one does. When we serve it underneath a dome filled with smoke. And I like the guests to try to imagine themselves, you know, under the jungle canopy in a straw hut, cooking a mole with open fire and grinding the chiles and the spices with the metate, as it's done today, even.
Amy, I imagine these manuscripts can also tell us about more than the food itself. What have you learned from these books about the lives of the people who wrote them?
Some of them have newspaper clippings where they've cut recipes out of the newspaper and pasted them into the notebook. And in some of them, you can actually see where they've reused a notebook that had a different purpose. For example, one of them has what appears to be English lessons with the newspaper clippings on top of it. You also start to see things like illustrations, even a child's scribbles or doodles. So you really start to see an interesting window into domestic life and perhaps how women were learning to cook, what their favorite recipes were. And of course, some of them have little splashes of food on them, so you know that they were well-loved and used.
a true cookbook.
Amy Rushing is the Assistant Dean for Special Collections at the University of Texas at San Antonio Libraries. Rico Torres is the chef and co-owner of the acclaimed restaurant Mishli in San Antonio. I want to thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, cooking goals for the new year sorted out for you. Now, go get that almond-based mole going. Thanks to my colleague Carol Hills for that conversation. And this is where we leave you this Friday, wishing you a healthy, peaceful 2021. The world comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. We'll be back on Monday with more stories from the world.
From PRX.